Hi, everybody at in the meeting. I'm going to go ahead and escape. I think everybody's running.
Thank you, Ed.
Okay.
Bottom or I mean, we are.
I'm wondering that myself.
I don't know.
It was.
Morning, Chiragon. Can you hear us? This is Reno.
Hi, good morning. Yes, nice to see you all.
Okay, great. I don't know if you're ready to start, but I believe up here in Reno, I think we're good to go, and I think the audio, the technology seems to be working today.
All right, thank you so much. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Elizabeth Gunn, Chair of the Task Force on Power-Based Violence at Institutions of Higher Education, and pleased to call our meeting to order. We'll begin with a committee roll call. If you're here, please indicate. Ms. Leisha Allison. Ms. Leisha Allison. Dr. Kavita Batra.
Present.
Thank you. Ms. Patricia Car Charlton.
This is Daniel Archer. I'm her proxy today. I'm at Inchi.
Thank you. Dr. Stephanie Coleman. Believe Dr. Coleman indicated she would join late. Mr. Jordan Fichette.
Present.
Thank you. Ms. Erin Frock.
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Tabor Griswold.
Present.
Elizabeth Gunn, present. Ms. Christine Hall. Ms. Christine Hall. Ms. Linda King.
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Sean Mabanta. Mr. Sean Mabanta. Mr. Jose Melendrez.
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Allison Netsky.
Present.
Thank you. Ms. Michelle Sposito. Believe she said she'd be a few minutes joining us late as well. And Ms. Lindsay Walterbeek.
Present.
Believe we have a quorum. All right, thank you all. The first agenda item is public comment. Public comment will be taken during this agenda item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item until the matter is included on an agenda as an item on which action may be taken. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes per person. Persons making comments will be asked to begin by stating their names for the record and to spell their last names. The task force chair may elect to allow additional public comment on a specific agenda item when the agenda item is being considered. In accordance with Attorney General file number 000047, as restated in the Attorney General's Open Meeting Law Manual, the task force chair may prohibit public comment in the content of that if the content of that comment is a topic that is not relevant to or within the authority of the Board of Regents, or if the content is willfully disruptive of the meeting by being irrelevant, repetitious, slanderous, offensive, inflammatory, irrational, or amounting to personal attacks or interfering with the rights of other speakers. So with that, is there any public comment in person in Las Vegas? Seeing none, is there any public comment in person in Reno? Okay.
No public comment.
Thank you. Is there any public comment by telephone? And to join by telephone, dial 1-699-900-9128 and enter meeting ID 94046978707, and the passcode is 106363.
No phone callers in Reno.
Thank you. Okay. Without public comment, we'll move on to agenda item 2, which is my chair's report. A few updates for the task force. Some meetings I wanted to share with you all. On February 11th, I met with virtually with Serena Evans, Nevada Safer Act, regarding the Nevada Safer Act that interacts somewhat with our task force work. She's with the Nevada Coalition to End Domestic and Sexual Violence. We spoke, a couple of her colleagues were present as well, about the potential legislation and the interactions with the legislation under which we operate. I imagine that conversation will be ongoing as the first draft of that act is forthcoming soon. And I hope to continue in conversation about that matter. I also had the pleasure of meeting with Ms. Kelly Sherrato, who's also with us today. She's the Title IX director, Director of HR for NG, my apology. And we had the opportunity to speak a little bit about her work, and she'll be presenting today some of the interactions when appropriate between Title IX and our work. I also continue in regular conversation with our colleagues at NG who help facilitate this process, Mr. Chris Nielsen, Special Counsel, and Renee Davis, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I also continue to be in conversation with our colleagues at the University of Nevada, Reno, specifically the Survey Center, to continue conversations about additional survey data from the initial survey. So I appreciate those conversations and collaborations. I believe we still have one vacancy on the task force. That's a student vacancy. Waiting to be filled, and we look forward to welcoming a new student when the time comes. As you all know, we were intended to meet on February 6th. We didn't have a quorum, so we're meeting today, so it's nice to see you all today. And that concludes agenda item 2, chair's report. So we'll move on to agenda item 3, which is approval of the minutes. The minutes from our November 7th meeting were distributed for your review. Is there any discussion or correction to the minutes? Seeing none, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Jose Melendez, motion to approve.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Thank you all. The minutes are approved. All right. With that, once again, it's my pleasure to turn the floor over to Kelly Sherrato, Director of Human Resources for NG. Thank you for being with us today, and thank you for your valuable time and presenting on Title IX regulations that became effective on August 1st, 2024. To provide some context, this task force has from time to time had conversations that intersect somewhat, and or there have been inquiries about how our work aligns or does not align with Title IX and where those boundaries are. And so I very much appreciate your time and expertise today in bringing the conversation more explicitly forward to help us navigate this as appropriately as possible. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today. As the interim human resources officer for the Nevada System for Higher Education, I do appreciate the opportunity to discuss changes in the Title IX regulations and how they impact our community. Today, I will focus on the recent updates to the Title IX regulations, what they mean for our institutions, faculty, staff, students, and administrators, and how we've prepared for those changes. Before I do that, I do want to acknowledge and express great appreciation for Senior Associate General Counsel Linda King. She has been paramount to providing not only the legal guidance, but sufficient direction, support, and leadership regarding all things Title IX since I joined NCHI, which has not been that long ago and long before that. Additionally, I do want to acknowledge and express sincere gratitude to our Title IX work group. This group consists of Title IX leaders from all eight institutions that meet weekly to discuss updates to Title IX guidance and processes, reviewing of case studies, discussing updates to NCHI policy, among a number of other Title IX topics to ensure that NCHI and all the institutions we serve are receiving the best response and leadership in this space. For all of that, I appreciate you. And finally, I do want to thank the Chancellor and the board for all of their support, advocacy, and consideration with the Title IX space. So I'll talk about a little bit of background now and a little bit of review on Title IX and the importance of it. For those who may be less familiar with Title IX, it is a federal law that was passed in 1972 to prevent discrimination on the basis of sex in education programs and activities that receive federal funding. It's well known for its impact on gender equity in athletics, but is also addressing sexual harassment, assault, and other forms of gender-based discrimination in education settings. Title IX requires educational institutions to take appropriate steps to prevent and respond to incidents of sexual harassment and gender discrimination. And it is integral ensuring a safe and inclusive environment for all students and employees. In 2020, the changes to Title IX policy in the US were significantly changed, particularly in the area of how sexual harassment and assault cases were handled in school. Some of those main changes were a narrower definition of sexual harassment. The revised regulations define sexual harassment more narrowly, focusing on unwelcome conduct that is so, we'll use quotations here because this was the law that was changed, so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, it denies a person access to educational programs or activities. It also changed live hearings and cross-examination. So the new rules mandated that schools conduct live hearings for Title IX complaints with an opportunity for cross-examination of witnesses. This change was intended to give both parties an opportunity to challenge the evidence and testimony presented. Additionally, there became a limited scope of Title IX. The rules required that Title IX applies only to incidents that occur within the school's education program or activities, limiting schools' responsibility for incidents occurring off campus or outside of their control. Due process protection for the accused. So schools were required to give more rights to the accused, including notice of allegations, the ability to access evidence before a decision, and the right to an advisor during the hearings. The standard of evidence for determining guilt was also adjusted to the clear and convincing standard in some cases. Also, there was mandatory reporting requirements. So schools were required to designate a Title IX coordinator to oversee the process. And all employees who are not considered confidential resources must report incidents of sexual harassment. Additional changes were supportive measures. So schools were required to offer supportive measures to both the complainant and the respondent, even if a formal complaint was not filed. These measures could include academic accommodations or changes in housing or work assignments. And then the other additional changes were dismissal of complaints in the grievance procedures. So the regulations outlined when schools must dismiss a Title IX complaint, for example, if the alleged conduct does not meet the definition of sexual harassment under Title IX, or if it occurred outside the school's jurisdiction. And the rules set forth detailed grievance procedures that schools must follow, including requirement to provide written notice of the allegations and the right for both parties to appeal decisions made by the institution. Some of these changes were designed to enhance fairness for both complainants and respondents, but there was definitely a lot of controversy as to whether or not that was actually happening, and additional concerns that they could potentially deter students from reporting sexual harassment assault. So then we'll move on to 2024. It's just a short time ago, though it feels very long now. In April 2024, the Biden administration issued final regulations amending Title IX. The federal law prohibited sex-based discrimination in education, and these changes were effective August 1st of 2024. Some of the key modifications were expanded definition of sex discrimination, clarification of sexual harassment, protections for pregnant and parenting students, jurisdictional expansion and training and policy updates. So the regulations in 2024 explicitly prohibited discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics, broadening the scope of protections under Title IX. The definition of sexual harassment was updated to encompass a wider range of behaviors, ensuring that more incidents were addressed under Title IX. The regulations reaffirmed and strengthened protections for students who were pregnant parenting, ensuring they have equal access to educational opportunities. Title IX's jurisdiction was extended to cover incidents occurring off campus and internationally, provided they were a part of the school's education program or activity. And schools were then required to update their policies and provide training to staff to comply with the new regulations, ensuring a consistent and informed approach to handling discrimination and harassment cases. So during these 4 years, at Enshi, Ms. King and Title IX work group did really work tirelessly to update the Enshi board policy to change these processes that occurred in 2024 and their guidelines to ensure that Enshi and its institutions were in compliance with the changes to federal and state policy. As we moved into 2025, basically all of that was undone and we reverted back to the 2020 regulations. As such, on January 31st, 2025, and with the changes in administration, some of you have already become aware of the rescission of the 2024 regulations and reimplementation of the 2020 regulations. As such, on January 31st, 2025, the board approved policy revisions to Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 14 to bring Enshi's unlawful discrimination and sexual harassment policy and complaint procedures into compliance with the U.S. Department of Education's 2020 Title IX regulations as a result of the vacator of the 2024 Title IX regulations. At the same time, the board approved conforming revisions to Title II, Chapter 6 and 10 of the code pertaining to the rules and disciplinary procedures for faculty, except for DRI, and rules of disciplinary procedures for students, respectively on a temporary and emergency 120-day basis pursuant to Title II, Chapter 1, Section 1.3.3b. In the Board of Regents quarterly meeting in March, this Thursday and Friday, the code amendments will be brought back to the board to be permanently codified pursuant to Title II, Chapter 1, which provides that at least 30 calendar days before consideration by the board, proposed amendments shall be circulated to the chancellor and each system institution president for Senate for review and comment. The changes to the code amendments will align with the revisions to the Enshi policy and complaint procedures, which will reincorporate the 2020 Title IX regulations. Ultimately, this provides that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Many or most of your institution Title IX leaders and coordinators have attended a training on the 2020 regulations and more recently attended the ATICSA, Association of Title IX Administrators Advocacy and Support, which specifically focused on these new changes. And we'll say new changes with the understanding that they're new, but they're the same ones for 2020. In conclusion, I just want to acknowledge our commitment to this change and to your Title IX leaders' commitment to this change. We will continue to do the necessary work to create more inclusive and equitable environments across our campuses. While the regulatory landscape is shifting, not only in this space, but in other spaces, our commitment to fostering an environment free of discrimination and harassment remains steadfast. We must all continue to do the work together to ensure that every individual in our community is treated with dignity and respect. I appreciate your time this morning to present on this very important topic today. And as we continue to work together with the Power-Based Violence Council and Committee, I do encourage you to reach out with questions and concerns regarding these new regulations. Thank you.
Elizabeth Gunn for the record. Thank you so much, Ms. Sherrato. So our hope today was for you to present the information that you did. So thank you so much. Thank you for the depth and breadth of the information that you shared. We appreciate your expertise and keeping us up to date with that information. Some questions have come forward from task force members from time to time about specifically about Title IX and how it interacts with our work. And so we may want to invite Ms. Sherrato back to answer questions, yes, more specific questions at a later date. So if you all have those, if you have those topical at this time, feel free to ask now. We can also gather them asynchronously as well.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Ms. Sherrato or for the topic on the table?
I've stunned everyone.
Or bored everyone to sleep.
We appreciate the comprehensive presentation and helping us understand the most current law under which we're operating. Thank you.
It's a lot to digest, yeah, for sure.
Could you speak briefly for the benefit of the task force members, how the Title IX coordinators at institutions interact
with us or with each other?
And with each other.
That's a great question. And I think we have a couple of Title IX work group members here. So I'll kick it off, but I'd like for them to really discuss, because the work that they do on their campuses is so significant beyond this work group. So I'll pass that over. But essentially, we meet weekly and we discuss everything under the sun related to Title IX and in some cases, Title VI. So what we're discussing is when cases are coming to them, what nuances they're experiencing, what challenges within the policy they're experiencing, what cases may be really complex, how they may be cross over different lanes, and then how we engage with other units like HR, compliance, legal, to ensure that the complainants are, their rights are protected as well as the respondents. We have Dr. Armin Asherian here, and I'm not sure if we have any others on the call. I can't see who else is here, but I'd like to offer you an opportunity to kind of share your perspective and how this group works together as well.
Thank you. Armin Asherian for the record, College of Southern Nevada. I am the Title IX coordinator, the Title VI coordinator, the 504 coordinator, the affirmative action officer. If I'm missing something, Linda, chime in. And so the question is, how do we interact? And it's the answer is both formally and informally, mm-hmm, as one would expect. We have this team that we meet roughly once a week, once every 2 weeks. And I think, you know, Kelly described well, we try to figure out, you know, what are the needs that we have? What is it in the current Board of Regents handbook? It's working, it's not working. What would we like to see changed in the future? Part of our requirements is to come up with comments and critiques and ideas once a year. And certainly experience affords us with plenty of opportunities to explore that. And indeed we have, there's no one case that we receive which is prototypical, which follows the standard pattern. There's always a lot of interesting nuances, things that throw you off. So we do talk to each other a little bit about how would you do this? What would be the appropriate way to do that? How do you interpret this regulation given the situation? So we have quite a bit of collaboration, if you will. And it's a great support system for each other, simply because you can't do this in a vacuum. There's just no way. I hope that answered your question concerning how we work together. Was there another part to the question, or another question there? I thought there was.
I think that was it. And I'd just like to piggyback on what Armin said, which triggered what I think that overall the committee In my significant appreciation of what I've learned in my short time is ultimately consistency of application of our policies and processes. So we're all, this group works really closely together to kind of understand how each institution's Title IX unit works and working on that consistency and application and policy and process. There are going to be nuances based on how their units are structured and of course FTE and resources, but for the most part that all of our institutions are and their Title IX processes are working the same, which is excellent.
Thank you. Elizabeth Gunn, for the record. Any other questions, comments for Ms. Sherrato or agenda item 4?
I just have a quick question. I'm not sure the whole processes of Title IX, but as a student, I'm wondering your processes on how these changes will be made aware to students that this might affect. I'm just thinking of, I know it's a very endearing process for many students, and so how do you plan on approaching that as there's so many changes made on informing the students of that process? Again, I'm not sure the processes, but that's just what, as a student, what's going through my mind.
Thank you, Lindsay. That's a great question. So our first commitment was to ensure that the campuses were sending out a communication from their president's offices university-wide. So the students should have received that in their campus official communication. I would believe that the institutions would also be updating their websites and then notifying any complainants that come in of what the process is.
I'm assuring for the record, as some of you may be aware, while we were going through this whole process of invoking and converting to the 2024 regulations, there was an injunction placed against three of the institutions, UNLV, UNR, CSN, that basically with the majority of students that entry has right there. For us, nothing had really changed. We read the regulation, we readied ourselves for it. Nothing had, in sort of, I think it was a short interim period of time when we were under the 2024, had come in, at least not at CSN during that period of time. So we really had nothing to communicate,
yep,
in the sense of a change occurred.
Yeah.
There was not even enough time for that to let them know the 2024 change had occurred. And then the other thing is, I believe each institution has as a requirement to make students, to make available to students training, which we do through Vector Solutions. So.
Did that answer your question, Lindsay?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for that additional information. Any other questions, comments on agenda item 4, specifically for Ms. Sherrato? Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being here. And thank you for the important information. I'm sure we'll continue to discuss some of these nuances as our work unfolds. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Turning to agenda item 5, overview of statutory requirements of the Task Force on Power-Based Violence in Institutions of Higher Education. The goal of this agenda item is to lead task force members on a collaborative discussion of the makeup and duties of the task force, including discussions of requirements for administration of a power-based violence survey pursuant to our, NRS 396. To provide a little bit more context, in our two previous meetings, we've discussed the major components of our work, including a system-wide survey, gap analysis, the direction and timing of the task force. And so if you all will recall, we decided to pause and take a deeper look at the at the statute and align our work explicitly and accordingly. And I cannot thank you all enough for being willing to do this. And thank you so much for the inputting your information into our slides. And we will get underway with the presentation of the slides. And for those who are present today, when your turn comes, please just jump in and start facilitating your slide, your information. Panning out for one more moment, each of us has a section of the statute that we'll present, and then we'll discuss at the end the overview and next steps regarding our potential action, or how we might frame our potential action. So I believe looking at the slides, I don't know if we'll project those here, but they should be available to task force members in your materials for today. They were posted under, the link is under agenda item 5. And the first item is Dr. Griswold, our vice chair. She will kick us off with a presentation or a discussion of NRS 396141, which is the composition of the task force. So Dr. Griswold.
Thank you, Dr. Griswold, present here. I wanted to preface this information with a comment that the Task Force on Sexual Misconduct in Institutions of Higher Education was renamed the Task Force on Power-Based Violence at Institutions of Higher Education and passed into law during the 82nd 2023 legislative session through the signing of Assembly Bill 245 and became effective July 1, 2023. This was a new version of what had been created in 2021. So the membership composition changed a little bit and it increased from 14 to 16 members. The wide scope of this membership is that we have one each from the system institutions, and they are, as listed on here, the chancellor or designee, chief general counsel or designee, 14 representatives from the state college, community college, university, Title IX coordinator, and selected institutional organizations and selected professional skills. The accomplishment of this group, including the selected students with that were appointed with consultation from the Nevada Student Alliance. And we have researchers, and we have a medical professional and victim advocates. So we have one person representing the Greek Association and one from Student Affairs. So there's a nice cross-section here, which we had hoped would keep a nice balance going with this group. The successful implementation of the survey with Dr. Veronica DeHeer and the group over at the Judicial College, as you Grant Sawyer Center for Justice Studies, has made an important contribution to this discussion. Because of the rebooting of this task force in the 2023, the members who had been on the original one, this criteria of members serving two-year term and maybe appointed to one additional one, was basically rebooted and restarted all over again. So there's nobody really terming out quite yet. And we have the two vacancies, or say one vacancy, because I counted the list. We have 15 on the list. We have one vacancy in the students, and that is ongoing to find that position filled. And then the final comment I have here is that we're doing this out of the love of our wanting to help students with no compensation. And it's all a contribution of a great group of people with a myriad group of skills and acumen to contribute to this environment. Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Gunn, for the record, thank you, Dr. Griswold. I appreciate the situating of the membership per our statute. The next item is mine, which is 1415. This is an overview of our charges that are in the legislation. Review of results of a climate survey on power-based violence. We reviewed results in 2024, examined current procedures and protocols preventing, intervening, or responding, since this is a power-based violence. We reviewed this a few times, as noted in the implementation status on the right-hand side. This will be an ongoing and continual process throughout our work. Identify possible gaps in service that are available for victims of power-based violence. I'd like to pause here and speak to the robust services, offices, experts, personnel, programming that the institutions offer in terms of services. Our colleagues from across the system have presented a couple of times and spoken eloquently and shared the robust resources that are available. With that, it's still within our charge to identify gaps. And with a complex system and starting out at the beginning of our work, we are earnest about this work and trying to get at those gaps. It is a complex, complex evolving conversation. The next item is examine the correlation between social groups, campus life, and incidents of power-based violence. We have requested additional survey data that is forthcoming or that is under review and to better inform our work. The next item is each year hold a meeting open to the public to provide recommendations to the Board of Regents. This has been accomplished and is ongoing. In 2024, results of the power-based violence survey, the climate survey, were presented to the board, and the recommendation was to provide additional funding, which was accomplished, and for additional survey analysis. And so we are still in the process of additional survey analysis at this time. And this is another part of the statute that will be ongoing year over year. And the last one is no later than August of each odd number year, submit to the Joint Interstanding Committee on Education a written report summarizing our work. And this was accomplished on June 10th, 2024. And of course, it'll be ongoing every odd number year. This high level summary represents, again, a lot of detailed work of task force members. Dr. Griswold just reference the breadth and depth of experience that the task force members bring, and they do this work because they want to, and I appreciate that you all are willing to bring that expertise and time to do this work for the system and for our students. And so with that, I will turn the floor over to Ms. Linda King, Senior Associate General Counsel and task force member, will present us a couple of slides.
Thank you, Chair Gunn. Linda King for the record. Before I start on my slides, I wanted to go back to Dr. Griswold's slide on the task force composition and let everyone know that this Friday, the Nevada Student Alliance at their meeting will be voting on a student candidate to join the task force. So if there's a successful vote from the NSA, the Chancellor's office will be bringing forth that nominee at the next available board meeting. And I think there's some special board meetings in there, so perhaps the Chancellor's office could convince the board office to get us an appointment sooner rather than later. My slides deal with the climate survey on power-based violence. My first slide, NRS 396.142, is climate survey on power-based violence, the development, the contents, and provision to task force to the task force. So my slides are going to repeat a bit of what the chair has already told you. If money is available, the Board of Regents can appoint researchers that are employed within the system to develop the climate survey instrument. That was done. As we know, the individuals from within the ENCHI created the climate survey instrument. The instrument has certain mandatory standards. It must be fair and unbiased. It must comply with the highest survey research standards. and it must use scientifically valid measures and must be scientifically reliable. The statute also tells us that the researchers who are going to be developing it must use best practices. They must consult experts and they must consult with our student governments within the NCHI system. There are mandatory survey topics that must be included. And then there's also discretion where it's permissive to include additional information in the survey. You must have an option within the survey for students to decline to answer a question. The survey complied with all of these requirements. It did have that option. And then finally, once the climate survey instrument is completed, it must be presented to the task force for comment. And that was done in March of 2023. I've been with this task force when it was the task force on sexual misconduct, and now that it's the task force on power-based violence. There's a difficulty in continuity of work when your measures and your goals change rapidly. And it may not seem rapid, but for a group that only meets quarterly and for a board that meets quarterly, it's difficult to advance the work. I thank the members from Sexual Misconduct Task Force who are the continuing members on the Power-Based Violence Task Force, because without the leadership of this task force, this would not have been completed. But it was. And even though the law changed, we were able to modify the climate survey and have the survey implemented across the system. So my next slide is NRS 396.1425. And again, this is how are you going to administer the survey? What are its contents? And can an institution waive implementing the survey, implementing a climate survey? So again, all of the statutes are conditioned on if money is available. The Board of Regents is permitted to require, but the legislature was unable to mandate that the Board of Regents implement any type of survey. It's important to note that the Board of Regents did require the implementation of the survey instrument at all of the institutions. So the board has the power to require an institution to conduct a climate survey on power-based violence biennially. The survey must include questions developed by the researchers. So what happened in the case was we had the climate survey instrument developed and approved. So it was administered to all of the institutions. It makes a lot more sense, and it's a much more cost-effective measure to do it that way, rather than to have each institution creating its own instrument. And then, because if we do that, we're also going to have variations in the data that's collected. Although this statute does allow the board to require that. I kind of look at this statute and say, I don't think that our board has the money to be able to do that. And I don't think that we would get the greatest results out of our data if we were to do it that way. But this statute still includes information that applies to all surveys. So this information in 0.1425 applied to the survey that the board required would be implemented at each institution. So again, the questions were developed by the researchers. Additional questions were permissible. There was input at the task force review where some of the questions were modified and additional points were taken into consideration. The statute requires that every student take the survey or that it be delivered to every student. So this includes anybody who's enrolled at our institutions. And it doesn't matter if they're doing study abroad or if they're somewhere else, the survey has to go out to all students. When we collect information, we can't use personally identifiable information. We have to have an adequate number of complete responses to ensure that you've got a random and representative sample size. That was done. That's why we had the UNR Center helping us with their expertise. The survey was administered electronically. There were accommodations provided as required by the statute if a student needed that. And it's very important that the data and the reports that underlie any of the reports that are generated from the survey responses are confidential and they are not public records. So if we were to receive a public record for the raw data, that information would not be released to the public. What we are required to do, however, is to create a summary that is publicly available, and that was done. And first, it has to be submitted to the board. We had 120 days to do that after the survey was completed, and we were successful in doing that. And the survey results are now on the Power-Based Violence Task Force website. So, duties of the Board of Regents is the next slide, NRS 396.143. So these are the board's duties with respect to the climate survey. When the board requires that a survey is implemented, it has to take certain actions. And those include using the questions that are developed by the researchers, establishing a repository for the summaries of the surveys, post the summary of responses on its website, and adopt a policy on dissemination, collection, and summation of responses. So all of that has been done. The board has adopted an informal policy. There has not been any procedures and guideline manual changes that were done internally. The practice and protocol, it's been determined because we've got one survey only so far, that would be the repository for that is the website for our summary, and all of the data is stored with the center that created the survey or that administered the survey. And the unit in the chancellor's office that is responsible for this is academic and student affairs. So we've hit all of the requirements. The summary of the survey results was provided to the Board of Regents. It was posted on the website and provided to the legislature on February 1st, 2025. So our next requirement under NRS 396-159 is an annual report. The board has not required an annual report yet under this statute. The statute says that the board could, however, require an institution to prepare and submit an annual report, including various data points regarding incidents of power-based violence, which data must be available, disaggregated data by students and employees. So because the board hasn't required this yet, we don't have any information on this. And I really think that this reporting requirement ties into the policy work that the task force is always continually in the process of evaluating. It started in looking at a policy, a gaps analysis for each institution when it was the task force of sexual misconduct. Now it's repeated its gaps analysis for our new scope of power-based violence. And I really think that until there's more analysis done with policy as to whether or not our current policy provides for awareness prevention and complaints and remedies of the conduct that falls under power-based violence, that we wouldn't get to a reporting period. Right now, we have very defined reporting under our Title IX and non-Title IX incidents. Under non-Title IX incidents, most of what is defined as power-based violence under the statutes falls under our non-Title IX anti-discrimination policy. It is not explicitly spelled out in that way, and I think that that's where our gaps analysis is going to be headed. And when that, when the task force has an opportunity to finalize that analysis, then we could look at how is our reporting already capture complaints of power-based violence, because we know that our Title IX and Equal Opportunity offices already deal with complaints of conduct that is power-based violence. How are we going to further refine those definitions so that we could even have a reporting requirement as to just power-based violence specifically as a category of conduct, which of course it encompasses a lot. So are there any questions about our climate survey that we've done so far? I mean, this is ongoing. The chair has said before, this is ongoing work. There was not as much data, I think, as we had hoped for when the survey was administered, but it was successful, and there is data. And the experts who were looking at that said, we need more information, and that information is going to inform us on how do we make these policy recommendations and how do we go forward in addressing power-based violence. And that said, we'll take into consideration what happens in the legislature. It's difficult to get traction. It's difficult to keep moving but I'm really impressed with the work that the task force was able to do, even with a legislative change in, you know, finding the money to do this. It is expensive in a time when there's not a lot of money. So I appreciate all of the work that the leadership has done. It's been very impressive because, as Dr. Griswold said, this is work that the task force members do because they care about our students.
I have a quick clarifying question regarding
sure.
this survey. I have checked my email and also in my Nevada, and I was wondering where this email or where the climate survey was sent out. I heard that it was sent out on February 1st of 2025, or I might have written that down wrong, but in the past, I had never received this in my school email. So I was just wondering, clarifying on where this had been sent out to students. And I've talked to some other students at the campus who hadn't received this climate survey. So I'm curious if that might be affecting some of the results for this.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, Lindsay. So this was not an email that went out this year. This happened in 23. Mm-hmm. So this would have been an email in, I believe it was fall of 2023.
Yeah.
It would have been October. And Dr. Griswold can jump in with the exact dates, but okay. That's the time frame. So your institution, and I'm not aware, but you might want mm-hmm. to reach out to your Title IX office and talk to Ziva Edmondson.
Okay.
I don't know if the institution might have had a separate. If you're hearing things about, oh, hey, maybe we should have heard about something this year in 25, mm-hmm. your institution may have had a separate survey. But the survey here for the task force was in fall of 2023.
Okay. Even in 2023, I had not received, and some of the other students had not received this climate survey. So I just wanted to bring that to attention from things that I've heard as a student and my perspective on that.
Yeah, no, we appreciate that. And we welcome the student voice on that. So I would imagine that Dr. Griswold will probably reach out to you separately to find out about, you know, what were those email addresses so that, mm-hmm. you know, there are ways to go back and track that, because we do want to make sure that if there are students who say that they were present, had an email and didn't receive it, that we can go back and, you know, use our tech to find out what might have happened. That's awesome. An important lesson to something happened.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Ms. King. I appreciate the comprehensive explanation of the survey and the processes associated with it. Next is Ms. Erin Frock, who's a counselor at Truckee Meadows. Presenting NRS 396-144, requirements related to the grievance process. Ms. Frock?
Yes, good morning. My section was specifically regarding the requirements for training, transparency, communication, and confidentiality when handling grievance processes. The Board of Regents requires that anyone involved in the grievance process, for instance, the Title IX team must take yearly training on power-based violence and any additional training required by law. For example, the Title IX team at TMCC regularly takes training to stay up to date on new regulations and current best practices. In addition, both the person making the complaint, the complainant, and the person the complaint is about, the respondent, must be given the institution's rules on how this will be handled, evidence will be handled during the process. For example, each party will have an equal opportunity to present evidence and witnesses to the Title IX investigator handling the complaint, and the investigator must remain a neutral third party, gathering evidence without bias, ensuring a fair and balanced process. After the grievance process has concluded, the institution must tell both the complainant and the respondent the result within 14 business days, unless federal law says otherwise. And the institution should not reveal the identities of the complainant or the respondent to the public unless superseded by federal law. So the identities will be protected throughout this process. My Title IX coordinator felt it was important that I also stress that because federal law comes into play, it may override the NRS statute when necessary.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Ms. Rock. That aligns nicely with our agenda item for today, which is where and when our work may overlap and where the statute refers to Title IX. So thank you for that information. Any questions, comments about this slide? All right, thank you. Turning to Mr. Melendres, who's the Interim Vice President for Diversity Initiatives and Chief Diversity Officer at UNLV, who will present on NRS 396145. Mr. Melendres.
Yeah, so hello, everybody. Jose Melendres for the record. So I was asked to look at, I was asked to look at 396145, and I think it was 393147 as well that was put into my area. So I'll start with 147. What the Board of Regents may require an institution within the system to adopt a policy on power-based violence consistent with the state and federal law. So there were areas that they had identified to include, which included trauma-informed response, coordination with Title IX and memorandum of understanding that must be pursuant to the NRS 393147 code. Engagement must account for cultural competence reflecting diverse needs. I wonder if that's something that would be challenged under the current climate. Input from internal and external entities may be considered, and then allows for public comment and availability of such policy. Going down to 146, policy power-based violence adopted pursuant to 146 must include without limitation information on, and these are the four areas for information, reporting procedures in place, supportive measures, the process, what is the process for supportive measures, connection, collaboration, and access with local, state, federal law enforcement, and then establish procedures for the grievance process.
Thank you so much, Mr. Melendres. Any comments, questions on this slide, this information? All right, thank you so much for that. Turning to the next slide, Mr. Mabanta and Ms. Hall. Ms. Hall, if you'd like a co-facilitator, I'm happy to jump in. If not, I defer to you to present this information. Turning the floor over to you to make that determination.
Thank you so much. That's okay. I think I got it covered. I appreciate it. So this is a review of the section 147, 148, and 149. So basically, this section talks about how each organization or institution can kind of fulfill the requirements around what we should have available on our campuses. So 147 talks about the memorandum of understanding with organizations that assist persons involved in power-based violence, which basically talks about we can create partnerships with community-based organizations that do this work to fulfill these requirements if that's not something that's readily available on campus through another department. So some of the areas that can happen is through cooperation and training on the responsibilities of the organization to assist student victim survivors, including procedures for providing services to assist victim survivors. So basically we can partner with community anti-violence organizations to assist victim student survivors and know what the procedures are to access those services. We can also enter into MOUs or memorandums of understanding with organizations to assist in developing policies, programs, or training. We can also do that to provide direct services. So if an institution doesn't have a on-campus confidential victim advocate, we can enter into MOUs with victim advocates in the community to fulfill that requirement. So this includes an alternative for free and confidential counseling, advocacy, crisis services, access to forensical medical examinations, such as SANE exams, and confidential services. Another way that we can partner with community agencies is by providing prevention education services for students and employees. So again, if that's not something we have available on campus, we can partner with community organizations to do that. We are also, it also has a little section in there saying that the organization that we partner with is allowed to bill the institution for the services rendered. Which is, I think, is an important thing to point out here in this section, because a lot of our community anti-violence agencies are funded by grant funding, which is being threatened by current administration. So the next section, 148, talks about the designation of an advocate. So it basically tells us who can be an advocate. One is by partnering with a community agency to provide that advocate. Another option is to partner with another institution within NSHE who has an advocate. I think there's a stipulation in there that it says only if it's less than 1,000 students that reside, like live on campus. So an example of that would be our partnership with CSN and the Care Center at UNLV. Another one, the advocate also needs to have experience in advocacy and have completed 20 hours of relevant training, which ties back to another statute in the NRS that indicates what you need to be a victim advocate in Nevada, which is that 20 hours of relevant training. And that training needs to include awareness and prevention, Title IX policies around power-based violence and trauma-informed care. It has stipulations of who can't be an advocate. So no one within the Title IX office can be designated as an advocate, as a confidential advocate, campus law enforcement, or any official who can initiate or be a part of those administration of those disciplinary proceedings. Also, the other stipulation in the section is that if an in-person advocate is not available on campus, we must provide virtual advocacy services if we're not able to provide an in-person advocate. The next section, 149, talks about the duties and power of an advocate, including talking about where there's conflict of interest, how we would avoid, how we would address that. So some of the duties for an advocate is to provide resources and information around reporting and services and confidential services, notifying of rights and what supportive measures are available through either disability services and or Title IX, and help advocate and support them in obtaining those supportive measures on campus. Another stipulation is that they are confidential and not required to report to Title IX unless required. So there's definitely stipulations around how mandated reporting laws interact with this. So if there is a mandated reporting law that supersedes this, then that person would be required to report, but otherwise would be confidential. We also, in order to share information about a client, we would need to obtain written consent through some sort of release of information or waiver of confidentiality. Another stipulation for these advocates is that they cannot provide services to more than one party in the grievance process. This goes back to our conflict of interest piece. They can assist in reporting or attending disciplinary proceedings, whether that is with the Title IX office or in the reporting process with University Police Services. A disclosure to an advocate does not constitute notice of an incident to the institution, which would trigger a different process. And we also have in there that the institution can't retaliate against the advocate advocating for the client. So that is essentially a summary of those three sections. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Hall. I know this this part of the statute aligns with your work. So thank you for presenting that with such expertise, and we appreciate it. I'll turn the floor over to Dr. Kavita Batra, who's Assistant Professor of Medical Research Biostatistician at UNLV, who will speak to 396151.
Thank you so much. Yes, so I was asked to give overview of NRS 396.151, which relates to the prohibition against disciplinary action in certain cases of power-based violence and the review of related misconduct. So there are two sections, and I'm going to talk about the main focus, key conditions, and the purpose. In section one, the main focus outlines situations where a complaint reporting party or witness who report an alleged incident of power-based violence should not face disciplinary action related to minor violations such as drug or alcohol use, trespassing, or unauthorized entry. The key conditions, the disciplinary actions or sanctions may only be imposed if, in two instances, the report was not made in good faith, implying that the individual is not reporting the incident honestly or sincerely. And the second condition is if the violation was serious, meaning the misconduct is in question is severe and could pose a risk to the health and safety of other person. And the goal here is to protect individuals who report incidents of power-based violence from facing penalties for conduct violations directly related to their reporting, unless the situation involves serious conduct. In Section 2, the main focus gives the Board of Regents the authority to require a review of disciplinary actions taken against reporting parties or witnesses to determine if there is any link between their disciplinary issues and the reported power-based violence incident. And the intent is to ensure that disciplinary measures are not unfairly applied due to retaliation or bias stemming from the reporting of power-based violence. And this review process helps identify any potential connections between the misconduct for which the individual was disciplined and their involvement in reporting or witnessing the violence. So overall, this particular section is designed to protect those who report power-based violence from facing unnecessary or punitive disciplinary actions related to minor violation, provided their report is made in good faith, and to ensure a fair review of any disciplinary actions in cases involving witness or reporting parties. The law aims to encourage reporting of such incident without fear of unjust punishment. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Batra. We appreciate that. Any questions, comments about this information? We'll move on to the next part of the statute, which is 396, 151, and 152, 153. Ms. Michelle Esposito, Director of Equal Employment, Title IX at UNLV. I believe she's joined us. So Ms. Esposito, I turn it over to you.
Thank you. So the two sections that I will be reviewing focus on important training and programming requirements. So first, under 396.152, the Board of Regents may require institutions to provide training on two key areas. The first is grievance process training. So institutions must train their staff on the grievance process, ensuring they understand how complaints are handled in accordance with federal regulations. And the second is power-based violence awareness and trauma-informed response. So the board may also require that Title IX coordinators and campus safety staff receive training on identifying and responding to power-based violence in a trauma-informed way. Turning to 396.153, there's a broader focus on awareness and prevention programming for both students and employees. So if this training is required by the Board of Regents, this programming must cover the following topics: consent, and how it applies to sexual conduct with another person, impact of drug and alcohol on consent, reporting options, so detailed information on how to report incidents of power-based violence and the effects and methods of reporting each reporting option, including confidentiality considerations, the institution's grievance process, so information about how the institution addresses allegations, along with a description of potential sanctions for those found responsible, advocacy and support, so contact information for any designated advocates, as well as resources available for those affected by power-based violence, bystander intervention, so strategies for intervening in potential incidents, and then risk reduction, so approaches to reduce the risk of power-based violence, and then to ensure effective delivery of these programming, institutions shall coordinate their programs with the Title IX coordinator and potentially with law enforcement or advocacy organizations. And additionally, there are requirements. So students have to attend the programming at least once within the first two semesters of enrollment, and employees must attend every 3 years. And lastly, the programming must be the programming must be culturally responsive, addressing the unique challenges faced by individuals based on factors like race, national origin, disability, and those other protected categories. Institutions can offer these programs in person or virtually, and they can include them in courses for newly enrolled students. And then lastly, institutions are encouraged to include resources and course syllabi, such as information on reporting options, counseling services, community-based organizations, and supportive measures available to those who have experienced power-based violence.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Posito. Any question, comments, any questions, comments on this information? All right, thank you. We'll move on to some of our definitions. This is Ms. Walterbeek. This is your the next slide is yours. Actually not. I'll skip that. Let's go with Mr. Bichette's slide, which is NRS 396154 and 155. I don't know if Mr. Bichette has joined us. If not, I'll present this information.
I'm here. Thanks so much.
Okay, wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. So 396154 states that the Board of Regents may require institutions to determine responsibility using preponderance of the evidence. So you'll see on the slide, I put a little chart on there, but preponderance of the evidence essentially means more likely than not, which is 51% or more, which is different than clear and convincing evidence, which is highly probable at 70% or more, or beyond a reasonable doubt, which is almost certain, which is at 95 to 99%. And 396155 states that if someone over the age of 18 reports power-based violence on an NSHE campus, the Board of Regents can choose to keep the identity private. They also can choose not to punish the accused, but keeping in mind that the institution might still have to share information if the law requires it, and explicitly outlines that when they're making a decision, the institution should consider whether or not the accused is likely to harm others again or repeat harmful behavior.
All right, thank you. Thanks so much. Any questions, comments on this information? We're only experts in the statute in just another moment or two. We have two more slides. Dr. Stephanie Coleman, I'm not sure if you've joined us.
I have, Dr. Gunn. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Dr. Stephanie Coleman. Hi, Vice President of Student Affairs, Nevada State University. These last two statutes are actually more about how we communicate with the complainant and the respondent. So NSHE must provide a similar communication process to both the complainant and the respondent. That one is key. So whatever we're doing for one, we have to do for the other. They must be notified at the same time regarding findings from the investigation. And again, I just want to emphasize, they must be notified at the same time. Bullet two for the statute 156, the complainant's sexual history is not introduced unless questions or evidence can demonstrate how consent was discussed or provide evidence of another person. I have a feeling that this is a little different from the current Title IX regulations, but again, the complainant's sexual history can be introduced. The last section, 1.7, is the no contact directive. And again, pay attention to the language. We don't have to. A no contact directive can be issued to prohibit both the complainant and respondent from contacting each other, especially if it's around their safety. If the respondent is found responsible, a no contact directive must be applied to both parties. So just want to emphasize that one, if the respondent is found responsible. And the last part, both parties must be given an explanation for the no contact directive, as well as being informed that any violation will result in further disciplinary actions.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Any questions or comments on this information? All right, our last slide, Dr. Allison Netsky, Vice Dean of Clinical Affairs, Professor of Psychiatry, UNLV, to finalize our presentation today.
Well, thank you, everyone. So the NRS 396158 relates to a person who experiences power-based violence and a request for a waiver of certain requirements related to grade point average, leave of absence, or financial aid or scholarships. So the first point is states a student who experiences power-based violence may request a waiver from any requirement to maintain a certain grade point average, credit enrollment, or other academic or disciplinary record requirement relating to academic success for any scholarship, grant, or other academic program that's offered by the institution within the system, and that a waiver may be granted by the provost, dean, academic advisor, or other appropriate staff faculty member. And then part two is that a student or employee who experiences power-based violence may be granted a request to take a leave of absence, or to the extent an extension of the benefits of employment. So there are a couple of specific references to this in the handbook. One is Title IV, Chapter 18, Section 9, which is in relation to the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship Policy and Procedures, which basically states that a party may request a waiver from the continuing eligibility requirements established in the Governor Gwynne Scholarship Requirements, and the Chancellor's Office and the Department of Academic and Student Affairs can establish a process for reporting waivers granted to the Treasurer's Office, who governs the scholarship. Next is the Title IV, Chapter 18, Section 3, which is in relation to waiver of other scholarship requirements. And so it basically states that a party can request a waiver from any requirements related to grade point average, credit enrollment, or other requirements related to maintaining eligibility for a state or other institutional scholarship or grant, and that the institution will create a process for this and create an institutionally designated individual or an appeals process for granting this. And then finally, the Title IV, Chapter 8, Section 14B and D states that there will be supportive measures and remedies that for students that include submitting a request for a waiver of scholarship or grant requirements, and also submitting a request for a waiver of the requirements for the Governor Gwynne scholarship. And so basically students wishing to request waivers for the requirements for scholarships or grant requirements are required to take part in a campus complaint process that is outlined. The waiver is one possible supportive measure or remedy. And for the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship, power-based violence or sexual harassment is the only basis for a waiver of those requirements. And if the campus determines that a waiver is appropriate, then they will notify the system office that will then liaise with the state treasurer's office as they govern the requirements of the scholarship. And so that is a brief summary.
Thank you, Dr. Nevsky. Any questions, comments on this information? I'd like to add that this liaises with the information that Vice Chancellor Davis presented at our November meeting about these resources available to our students. All right, thank you all for doing this. Appreciate your time in preparing the information and reviewing the information together today. My hope is that it can help situate and direct some of our future meetings. I have a few thoughts about how we might use this information, and then I welcome discussion from you all. So in reviewing the statute, there are several components we've already identified. One is how we think of policy review, and Ms. King referenced that earlier. That would inform how we evaluate our programs, and we have a nice set of materials where we can take a look at those again without having to invite folks back to present again. Although if we have questions, we can certainly invite our colleagues back. We have our experts at the table, and an expert at the table for our Title IX and equal employment rules and regulations. There's also the issue of community partners. We already have some excellent community partnerships where we might want to explore those further to create, to shore up some of the gaps if we identify gaps. And so by way of next step, I would recommend that we move forward with a policy analysis that would inform those subsidiary components, which are our programmings, partnerships, and so forth. So I'll pause there and ask if anyone has additional thoughts, considerations, feedback, suggestions. Yes, Ms. King.
Thank you, Linda King, for the record. I like the idea. I think that's where the task force needs to move on policy. And I think as a first step, to hear from, I know we already have information, to look at the information that we already have to find out. I think the question we need to answer is, does current policy address awareness, prevention, handling of complaints, and remedying conduct that is power-based violence as defined under Nevada state law? We may find that even though we're not using the words power-based violence, that the conduct is already being addressed and those complaints are already being addressed, and to what extent at our institutions. Before we get into maybe looking at other institutions who have called their policy a policy against power-based violence, to kind of do the nuts and bolts analysis of, are we addressing it already? Does our policy already reach that? Just sort of maybe as a first step in the policy analysis. Just a suggestion. Just a
Elizabeth Gunn, for the record. Thank you, Ms. King. I think that makes absolute sense, because we already have some of those policies, language in place, and can rely on what is already working well. Thank you. Other questions, comments, feedback?
Christina Hall, for the record. I wonder if there is something that this committee, this task force needs to discuss regarding how recent executive orders and things impact the work here, as far as DEI. You know, there's a number of things that kind of intersect with current federal policies. And so I think we should continue moving forward with the work. I think it is really important on our campus to address power-based violence and to move forward with this. And I think we need to talk about how those things impact this work. So I wonder if that's something we need to bring to the table.
Let's put that for the record. Thank you, Ms. Hall. I think that is a salient question on many people's minds. I will say, while some of our work may interact, I will rely on consulting with our counsel to answer those questions.
Well, just
Linda King for the.
Sorry.
Just Nielsen for the record. I think that suggests some of the, I believe we're still on number five, but I believe some of these new ideas for possible future agendas would be probably most appropriate on just being restated under new business request, and which would be agenda item number six.
Thank you. Sounds like a good time to move to agenda item number six. So let's move to agenda item number six, which is new business. Items for consideration at future meetings may be suggested. Any discussion under item new business is limited to description and clarification of the subject matter of the item, which may include the reason for the request. No substantive discussion may occur at the meeting on new business in accordance with Nevada open meeting law. So with that, Ms. King, would you like to graciously restate your thoughts on new business?
Sure, Linda King for the record. I'd like to request a new business item for the task force to look at policy and whether or not creation of new policy is needed, or if our current unlawful discrimination and harassment policy sufficiently encompasses power-based violence conduct as defined by state law. I'll wait for Ms. Hall to restate her item before, sure. But I do have some thoughts and comments on that.
Thank you, Ms. Hall.
So my proposal was for new business would to see how current federal policies and regulations are impacting the work of the task force around DEI efforts and our policies and procedures for addressing power-based violence, particularly around the provision of providing advocates on campus and also prevention education and awareness curriculum. Some of the organizations and internal departments in NSHE are grant funded, which may be threatened. And so there is a funding impact there, being able to address those things on campus that we may run into in the future. So that's my suggestion for future business.
Thank you. Ms. King, do you have some additional thoughts on the business?
Just as Chief General Counsel's designee, I want our counsel to know I'm not getting into a substantive discussion, but I think it's important for the committee to understand Ms. Hall's points are incredibly important, particularly with respect to grant funding, because the advocacy work is funded, I believe, primarily through grants. But I want everybody to have a bit of assurance in that this work deals with discrimination and harassment, and the discrimination and harassment federal laws and state law have not changed.
Thank you.
Also, real quick, Jose Melendres, I put a document in the chat. I don't know if everybody can access that or not, but anyway, there's a lot of information that we've been tracking this, obviously, in the DI offices, and there's a lot of stuff that's coming out. But there was a really strong memorandum that came out from a group of academic legal scholars, and they really provided a lot of detail and information about the executive orders that are coming out. And as you all know, and I'm not an attorney, but for those of you who are, you know, there's just a ton of litigation moving forward, and it's all going to get tied up in the courts for who knows how long. So just I dropped it in the chat. If anybody wants to access that, it's a really good resource, or just really, they really broke down really nicely about what's going on the federal level, and where DEI and all these other things are still, basically they're still law and can still be followed. So just as an FYI for everybody, it's in there.
Thank you. Any other suggestions under agenda item six, new business? Let's
Favorite Griswold, for the record, this might be stating the obvious, but I'd like to see a calendar for the perhaps revisions to the survey and our projected implementation. And that's because Lindsay Welterby brought it up, an analysis of how complicated it was to administer the survey, because her comments perhaps implied that they didn't get it out as well as we thought that it had. It was done underneath a very tight guideline. And so I'd like to have a little bit more planning to be able to do that appropriately.
Thank you. Any other suggestions for new business under agenda item 6? So to recap, we have a review of existing policy to identify where task force may or may not need to recommend additional policy, or if current policy covers what we may recommend to the board. Potential discussion of the impact of recent changes in recent executive orders that impact grant funding that funds some of the advocacy work across institutions. Consideration of a calendar for a subsequent survey, and I'll add perhaps additional data analysis as we consider the original survey, the additional data that we requested. With that, I'll move to item number 7, public comment, and read the information again about public comment. Public comment will be taken during this agenda item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item until the matter is included on an agenda as an item on which action may be taken. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes per person. Persons making comment will be asked to begin by stating their name for the record and to spell their last name. The task force chair may elect to allow additional public comment on a specific agenda item when that agenda item is being considered. In accordance with Attorney General File 00047, as restated in the Attorney General's Open Meeting Law Manual, the task force chair may prohibit content if the content of that comment is a topic that is not relevant to or within the authority of the Board of Regents, or if the content is willfully disrupted to the meeting by being irrelevant, repetitious, slanderous, offensive, inflammatory, irrational, or amounting to personal attacks, or interfering with the rights of other speakers. Public comment in Las Vegas. Public comment in person, Reno.
No public comment in Reno.
Is there any public comment via telephone? And I can read the information if needed.
And there is no one wanting to comment on the telephone.
Thank you. With that, I will adjourn the meeting at 10:35. Thank you, as always, to our colleagues in both offices for your assistance in arranging the meeting. And thank you all, as the task force members in the show, for your time today. Very much appreciated. Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.